After the 2016 presidential election delivered what a lot of people felt were unexpected results with the Trump victory, NPR's Melissa Block decided to take a road trip to get to know people living in non-coastal states a little better. First stop, Independence, Kansas.
In a town like this, they tell me, you tread carefully when talking politics.
I mean, we do express our opinions, but then we kind of back away politely.
We are Kansas polite.
Yes.
We are a Kansas polite community.
Good old Midwest.
Yes. Right. It's kind of like, yes, I feel this way, but I understand how you feel. You know, it's like, because we're a small town and we all have to get along.
She got a walking tour from the local newspaper editor.
Well, I was hoping you could walk us around.
Yep, we can do that. We can do that.
Great.
Can I bring my wife with me?
Sure.
Amy.
We head out toward the main business street in Independence, a shadow of what it used to be.
We used to have a JCPenney department store over here. That's now gone. We had a furniture store. It's gone. A Hallmark store. It's gone. We had a clothing store, department store. It's gone.
Melissa Block is not the only one going searching for understanding in the past year. HuffPo went on a tour called Listening to America. The BBC went on its own Great American Road Trip. Mark Zuckerberg has been pictured on tractors as part of his education. And the founder of eBay has underwritten a research project called Stranger in My Own Country. Even comedians are doing it. Sarah Silverman's new show, I Love You, America, is a road trip attempting to bridge that divide between the coasts and the rest of us. So a year into this national project to pay more attention to us, how is it going? I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard. And now I'd like to welcome Ted Genoways to begin with. He's a writer and journalist in Nebraska. Hi, Ted.
Hi. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for being here. So just to take people back a little bit, in December of 2016, you wrote an article in the New Republic called The Great Abandonment, where you tried to explain to a national readership something they may not have understood about the realities of the rural Midwest, including something very basic. The first line is, first, remember, Nebraska is a place.
Right, exactly. I wanted people to think of these places as something more than just political props or just places. I mean, I live in eastern Nebraska, not too far from Iowa. The press has a tendency to arrive every 4 years when it's getting to be primary time. And I want people to start to think of these places as real places that exist at all times and that have all kinds of levels of complexity that are worth exploring throughout any political cycle and at any time.
So has it been hard for you in any way that it's a political moment that fueled the interest? I mean, does that skew what you see as the results of some of these projects?
Well, I think certainly there's a tendency to frame stories in terms of, you know, making forays into Trump country, which, of course, assumes a certain homogeneity and also assumes that there are not, you know, complexities within these states and even within the individual communities. And I think, you know, if what the national press really wants is to have a true understanding of these flyover states, then what is required is more than just the drop-in and more than just arriving with certain assumptions and even more than just coming to answer certain questions. I think the best way to understand these places is to try to greet them on their own terms and to develop contacts with people in these places that helps you understand them on a daily basis rather than just at the height of certain political moments.
Can you give an example of maybe a time when reporters from the coast came to a place in the Midwest with specific questions that ended up that the questions that they were asking weren't the ones that the people in that community were asking or really wrestling with?
Yeah, I mean, I've spent a lot of years covering the Keystone XL pipeline, which to me seems a particularly good example, where there's something that, to be sure, is a national and international issue. This project that is, you know, traversing close to 2,000 miles from the Alberta tar sands all the way to the Gulf Coast of Texas, But the main battleground has been the resistance among farmers and ranchers in Nebraska. And there's been a tendency to show up and to talk about these issues in terms of climate change and in terms of international agreements. And the reality is that the farmers and ranchers here in Nebraska are concerned about the project because of the threat that it poses to the Ogallala Aquifer. And what that means is that it poses a threat to their well water, for their drinking water, for their families, for irrigation, and for watering livestock. And so for them, it's a very local issue. And when reporters show up asking questions that don't really have anything to do with their concerns, they end up talking past each other. And I think it, again, it's important to arrive in some of these places just willing to ask, you know, what are your concerns? What are the things that have catalyzed the opposition here in ways that it's not catalyzing in other places? And that project, it seems to me, is a great example, because it is, in fact, drawing a line through the middle of the country. And in some places, there's been staunch opposition, and in other places, there hasn't been. And it's revealing then that there is a great deal of diversity of opinion and ability to organize, and just, you know, there's a great deal of complexity surrounding that issue.
You know, I'm curious whether you've seen any really positive reporting or just examples of great storytelling and important observations to come out of this year-long effort and interest in capturing life in the Midwest.
Yeah, I mean, to be clear, I don't think that it's impossible, obviously, for reporters to catch on to stories that that they find that and find an interesting angle on them. But I think, you know, that some of the most successful examples, I mean, the one that I'm always pointing people to is the long feature piece by Stephanie McCrummon that was in the Washington Post called The Homecoming. I thought that was a brilliant piece of
reporting.
Tell us
about it.
And writing. Well, it's a story that is mostly, I mean, the whole framework of the story is set on the midway of the Clark County Fair in Missouri. And I don't know how the story was reported, but it certainly reads as if the reporter was simply at the county fair and noticed a young woman working at one of the concession stands who was reading a copy of James Joyce's Ulysses and thought that was interesting. And what that bit of noticing seems to have yielded was the story of a young woman who is from a very small town in Missouri, but has, through college education and some of the travels that she embarked on through her university, has been to Europe, has come into contact with Syrian refugees, has now found a husband who is Guatemalan, and has returned home with a very different perspective on things, and is finding it difficult to connect and communicate with people who she's known her whole life. And to me, that's an authentic and recognizable story of small towns in the middle of the country right now. There is a great deal of brain drain that's talked about, but there is also an effort by a lot of young people to try to come back and contribute to their communities, and it's not easy. And those stories of how one's upbringing comes into conflict with one's education and one's expanding view of the world, it seems to me, is fertile ground for great storytelling. And certainly that piece I thought was extraordinary.
Well, I'm going to turn to our listeners to see, you know, if anyone else heard anything this year, read a story this year that seemed to capture the Midwest in an interesting way. Call 816-235-2888 to weigh in on the media's attempt to understand what they often call Trump country by visiting the Midwest and telling stories from here. What have they gotten right or wrong? What have you noticed and heard? 816-235-2888. I'd like to turn now to someone who's been reporting on the Midwest as an outsider looking in, Tripp Gabriel, national correspondent for the New York Times. He's done stories on truckers in Iowa, a family of brothers in Indiana. He's been paying a lot of attention to us. Hi, Tripp.
Hi, Tina. Thanks for having me.
So tell me a little bit about your background, where you come from, what your story is.
I'm a New Yorker. I live in the New York suburbs currently. I live in different parts of the country, but I'm a political reporter primarily. And years ago, before, in the run-up to the 2016 election, the political editor of the Times looked at me and said, I'm to Iowa for a year to run up to the caucuses. You seem like you fit in really well in the Midwest. I thought that was a pretty interesting and curious observation. I'd never lived west of the river or Rocky Mountains before that, but she pegged me in some sense. So I actually, on behalf of the Times, I had an apartment in Des Moines for a year and covered primarily the political jockeying. There were so many candidates in the race at that point. After that, after the Iowa caucuses in January of 2016, all of the presidential campaign in many of the battleground states, but that
sounds like your phone might be going off there.
I'm sorry about that.
That's okay.
Not very much a Midwestern story. I mean,
yeah,
the Trump campaign figured out that its path to the White House was through the northern Midwest, and so we spent a lot of time in places like that.
What is your understanding of why the Times has been interested in you providing further coverage of the Midwest beyond the election?
Well, I think you put your finger on it exactly at the top of the conversation, and the Times is not alone. I think there was a pretty general recognition, among certainly the national media that we missed Donald Trump got elected, and the story of that was about voters and people whose voices weren't as often included in the in the national narrative about, particularly at least in our political sense. So, I'm a national reporter and I get to roam around, but I mean, we've always had the New York Times always had bureaus in the center of the country. We have a Kansas City bureau, we have a Chicago bureau, we have a reporter in these days. There's a paradox to this effort, to understand so-called flyover country. While the national media has shown it wants to devote more attention to parts of the country to help elect Donald Trump, I mean, President Trump himself is running such a chaotic White House that Washington has become even a bigger story than usual. So I love the homecoming that was attended and other coverage like it, and I've tried to tell stories like that myself, but it's an interesting question whether this kind of coverage is being noticed widely.
Tripp, I'm going to have you hang on for a second while we sort of get a better connection with you so that people can hear you a little bit better. And I'm going to turn back to Ted Genoways for a second. Ted, we're going to get right back, as I mentioned, to Tripp, but you were part of a big meeting of Midwestern journalists at Denison called Between Coasts. What sorts of things were people wrestling with there in terms of getting the Midwestern story or stories out there for the rest of the country to hear?
Yeah, well, the whole concept of that in from the very beginning was trying to figure out how to make better connections between these Midwestern and often rural places and the increasingly coastal and urban media that is thought of as national. And some of that was trying to understand some of the losses that have occurred. I mean, we've heard there, mention of how places like the Times have had bureaus and and covered all parts of the country over the years. That used to be true of essentially every newspaper, that you would have bureaus in all parts of the country and reporters who could go out and cover things. That's really gone away. And not only over the last 30, 40 years, that sort of steady decay, but in the last decade, ever since the financial crisis, when a lot of publications contracted, they did so by closing those bureaus. And as they've even started to expand again, there's been a tendency to rebuild in electronic media that are in their home offices. And so the middle of the country doesn't have as much of a connection into the national media in the way that it used to. And so the questions that we're exploring are really, how do we reestablish that? How do we get a national media that may not even know what the important questions are in the middle of the country to pay attention to those issues and to make them of national concern as they should be? And I would say that we don't have any grand solutions other than, you know, what's really required is a reinvestment in some of these areas. And that does mean money. It also means resources. It means having reporters who are here and ideally reporters who are from here, I think, in so that there are deep connections and that it is possible to tell stories with a certain amount of local authority.
Let's get back to Trip Gabriel with the New York Times. Trip, two of your stories that really caught my attention. There's one about truckers, and then there's one about three brothers in Indiana who have very different relationships with basically like international trade deals. Can you give us kind of like the brief synopses of those two stories real quick?
Sure, and they're really different. I mean, the truck driving story, I just went to a truck stop in southern Illinois, a place called Effingham, because I realized that actually these stories came out of each other, and I'm telling them in reverse order. So let me go back. I went to Evansville in southern Indiana to write about you know, the impact of international trade. President Trump had said that he was going to tear up the NAFTA agreement, and this was a hugely vote-getting issue for him. A lot of factories have departed in the Midwest, and Evansville is one of them. And I wanted to tell a story of how trade impacts people's lives, you know, in a more intimate way. And so I found three brothers, one of whom had been laid off when an Alcoa steel smelter, I guess they call it, went out of business because of Chinese competition. And another brother worked at a Toyota plant there, and Toyota was actually exporting a lot of its vehicles, and so trade was benefiting this brother. And the third brother was a school teacher, and he was a, you know, college-educated professional, but he was just deeply struggling economically.
Making less than his brothers in their blue-collar jobs.
Yeah, so it was a conversation between these three men who had all voted for Trump, were all, you know, Indiana Republicans. Their father had been a coal miner, and the issue of the economic, you know, pluses and minuses of making stuff in America and selling it abroad or importing stuff, you know, under a tariff that the president may impose, you know, was much more complex and nuanced than I think that the political campaign rhetoric suggested.
I'm wondering, though, when you came back to New York after that story in particular, I am curious. It seems like it was also more complex and nuanced probably than a lot of people you were used to rubbing elbows with might have imagined. I mean, did you feel a disconnect when you came home and started talking to people about what you'd seen and experienced?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, you know, the so-called elitist view of trade, and it's been a bipartisan consensus for a long time, is that all trade is good trade. The more that we lower barriers to trade internationally, the better it is. And, you know, what people who are not directly exposed to the downside of this, because they might not have, you know, jobs in manufacturing, don't understand is that there are winners and losers in a trade deal, and the winners might be you know, the folks who can go to a Walmart and buy stuff cheaper because it's made abroad. But there are a lot of losers, you know, and a lot of them are in the American heartland who don't have college educations necessarily, but have had blue-collar careers, and those are the plants that have closed. So, yeah, in where I live in New York, there are no factories. I mean, there actually used to be a GM factory, but it closed decades ago. So we don't have a lot of exposure to people who've lost their jobs, you know, as a result of NAFTA.
So as a coastal consumer of media, but one who's spent time now immersed in the Midwest, do you see things in national references to this part of the country that kind of pique your curiosity a little bit or maybe don't sit well with you?
In terms of misunderstandings?
Yeah.
Well, I think the whole, you know, I learned to bite my tongue and not say Rust Belt. I knew that was a kind of those are fighting words in many parts of Ohio and Michigan and Indiana. I mean, yes, a lot of industrial economy has been eroded, but you know, it's too easy to paint a picture of you know, despair and sort of economic hopelessness in a lot of the country, where that's just not the case. I mean, living in Iowa showed me that, you know, it's a prosperous place in many parts of the state. The farm economy is thriving, and it was thriving, you know, before many other parts of the country recovered after the 2008 recession.
Do you see the effort from national media outlets, just from your perspective, being sustained? Do you think that it's going to hang on through another year, 2 years, three, four?
I don't think so. I mean, in one of the scenarios that has kind of played out is, I mean, Tez's right. There's a lot of kind of parachute journalism in which you go to, which reporters, you know, go to a diner in a rural part of the country and find, you know, six guys around a table of knowledge discussing politics, and we kind of, you know, download their views. And that are you, and basically the storyline is, do you still support Donald Trump? And you know, the answer has come back, you know, pretty strongly. Yeah, we do. And that kind of coverage has been parodied. So I think that people like me and probably others are, you know, pretty hesitant to sort of repeat that sort of thing. So, and I guess if that goes away, it's not a bad thing.
But just something has to replace it.
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, picking up on the conversation earlier that Ted was discussing, you know, a lot of the national conversation or the national spotlight, you know, comes to rural parts of the country through a presidential campaign, and so the kind of people that come and want to talk to Iowans or Nebraskans or folks from Indiana or rural Michigan, you know, tend to be political reporters, and their perspective is narrow. I mean, it's about the issues that are driving politics, and a lot of those issues are generated by the campaign and the candidates themselves rather than by
the people,
you know, being organic, you know, coming out of people's actual daily concerns.
Ted Genovese, we're going to have to run in a second, but I wonder if you'd like to respond to what you've just heard.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I would say that this again is the reason that I think that that having people who are living here full time, who are ideally from here, is an important thing, because we're connected to those narratives as they are currently lived, but also as they fit with the historical framework of this place. And I think that as we try to push past this sort of cliche of people talking around the table in the diner and get to what the actual concerns are and the essence of these places, I think it only makes sense to turn to the people who have spent their time studying these places and living in them.
Ted Genovese, Trip Gabriel, thanks so much.
Thank you.
When we return, KCUR's own CJ Janovee with her new book, No Place Like Home, Lessons in Activism from LGBT Kansas. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman, here now with my friend and colleague CJ Janovee, who's out with a new book about the fight for LGBT rights in Kansas, where the resistance to that fight could be oppressive and where the people who spoke up faced real consequences. Welcome to the show, CJ.
Hi, Gina. Thanks for having me.
The germ of the idea for this book came to you on June 26, 2013. Tell me about that day and what it was like for you.
June 26, 2013 was a Wednesday. And so a lot of people are probably, this weird moment is going to get lost to history probably, but let me jump forward to June 26, 2015, which was the day that the U.S. Supreme Court declared gay marriage, same-sex marriage, legal throughout the country, and everybody could get married in all 50 states. 2 years before that, same day, June 26th.
Weird.
There were two other Supreme Court decisions, one about Proposition 8 in California and another one about the great Edie Windsor's case, which overturned the Federal Defense of Marriage Act. So what happened was those two decisions in 2013 legalized same-sex marriage in some states, but not, you know, 20, 30 states that had passed constitutional amendments banning same-sex marriage a decade earlier. So it was just this weird, uneven legal landscape.
And you experienced that landscape here in Kansas City, but you were also noticing how your experience compared with sort of the national.
Yeah, there was a little rally that afternoon downtown at Ilis Davis Park, and, you know, a couple hundred of my LGBT brothers and sisters gathered there after work. And, you know, there were speeches, a little combo from the Mid-America Freedom Band played, Here Comes the Bride, I think. And I was just, you know, there's news reports that night that said everybody's celebrating and this is a historic moment, but it doesn't change anything for those of us who live in these states. Missouri had banned same-sex marriage. Kansas had banned same-sex marriage. And so we were celebrating this huge historic thing that had nothing, that didn't apply to us. And I thought, this is very, very weird. And I want to somehow tell everyone how weird that feels.
So that weird feeling took you to Kansas.
Yes.
For pretty extensive reporting over a period of years.
Yeah.
What was it that the fight in Kansas particularly said to you?
So in the summer of 2013, I was not working as a journalist. I had worked as a journalist for many years in Kansas City and at The Pitch, as you know.
Yes, and you were my boss there.
And in 2004 and 2005, when Missouri and Kansas were banning gay marriage, you and your colleagues and myself, we had all reported on that. And, you know, flash forward to 2013, I was not working in journalism, but I knew that, you know, I'd been reading the papers. I knew that activists in Kansas had been accomplishing things. And so I wanted to know what became of them. And I clearly needed to do some reporting. So this was, you know, this was like sort of on my free time, very early mornings, all weekends. And I just found people and talked to them. And I started hearing these incredible stories.
They are incredible stories. And I have to say, they can be really brutal. Like, if people are looking for a really sunny picture of activism, there are triumphs here, you know, and people do make progress, as you point out. But the path to get there is really devastating for a lot of these people.
Activism is hard. It requires a lot of work. It requires a certain mindset. It requires toughness. And I think a lot of people are now finding that out. In a political time in our country that's inspired a lot of people to become activists. I think what's instructive about this book is you have to really take the long view. You have to keep trying. And the stories in here sort of range from people whose lives were ruined to a young woman who started the Gay Straight Alliance at Hutchinson High School and is so generally comfortable in her life in Hutchinson that she didn't even really know about the same-sex marriage fight a few years before she was in high school.
So let's lay the political foundation for the moment when this overarching narrative of the book begins.
Yes.
There are two simultaneous things happening. One is that there's a handful of people working to get LGBT protections written into state statutes. But then while they're focused on that, they're kind of blindsided by a proposed amendment to the state constitution banning gay marriage.
Well, the gay marriage stuff, I think, is is the thing in 04 and 05. This was not some of my colleagues, compatriots in gay rights movement world might disagree with this, but I would argue that gay marriage in the mid-2000s was not a cause that was a priority for the LGBT movement in general. The LGBT movement in general in those days, really, people didn't want to get discriminated against. They wanted not to get fired from their jobs. They wanted not to get kicked out of their apartments. They wanted access to the same public accommodations everybody has. They didn't want to get beat up and killed. So it was really sort of a Karl Rove type led movement politically to get conservative politicians elected. This whole same-sex marriage scare was a way to drive social conservatives to the polls. And so there wasn't a group of people in Kansas who was really sort of ready to defend itself.
So in Kansas, the people who emerged did so kind of organically, as they emerged as leaders based on their own experiences.
There's a small handful of people who are like, wow, the state legislature's trying to get gay marriage banned, and this is going to hurt us. It's going to hurt our communities. And there's like just two or three people who are like, okay, well, we need to do something about this. And so they sort of call a meeting at Washburn University, and they fight it as best they can, but they know they're going to lose. And, you know, 70% of Kansas voters banned same-sex marriage in 2005.
There is this, you detail some of the sort of like conversations in back rooms that people are having, or like moments where particularly a woman named Tiffany Moeller mm-hmm. is forging connections and making allies and doing so very quietly and very methodically. And some of the support that she finds is really surprising.
She finds support everywhere in the sort of hallways of the Kansas State Capitol. People, you know, sort of lobbyists come up and whisper to her and say, you should go talk to so-and-so. In those days, there were still moderate Republicans in the Kansas legislature, and particularly in the Kansas Senate. And there were some real heroes in the state legislature back in those days. There's a former state representative named John Ballou, who she went to talk with. And, you know, she was sort of scared, thinking John Ballou's like the most conservative, flannel wearing, you know, whiskey drinking, as I remember she describes him. And, you know, she went to see him, and he tells me in the book, there's no place in the Constitution where it says you get to discriminate against a group of people.
Or take a right away. I remember reading that passage, and, you know, that I think he put it as a question to her. Show me a place in the Constitution where a right is taken away. And she says, I can't do that. And I think he says, I was afraid you were going to say that.
Thank you for your careful reading, Gina. Thank you for remembering that. That's exactly the passage.
It feels like this is the kind of thing that people kind of hope to see in politics, these moments of people coming from different places, but understanding something about how our government is supposed to work and uniting around that. But in spite of all these moments like that one, there's still this crushing defeat.
And then there's another crushing defeat, and then there's two or three more, and then they start having victories.
Yeah, I mean, can we talk a little bit, though, about the defeat, the series of defeats? Because
yes.
It gets at, you know, what made this fight different in Kansas? You know, you mentioned early on in the book that there aren't national organizations throwing money at this movement in Kansas. Why not?
Because it was clearly not a good opportunity for return on investment. I mean, if you're a national organization, and you see, you know, just strategically looking at your resources, which are limited, where are you going to get the most return for you know, the donations that your organization has? And, you know, clearly in Kansas, you're going to lose. That's the thinking anyway. So that's what happened with the marriage amendment. But then out of that defeat, which is crushing, and the activists who were involved sort of, you know, fought among themselves, and that was very painful about what their strategy was going to be. They all met afterwards, and several of them, you know, they all had a bunch of different organizations. They joined together. There is a statewide LGBT advocacy organization called Equality Kansas. It exists to this day. It has chapters in cities around the states. There's another organization specifically in Manhattan called the Flint Hills Human Rights Project. These organizations sort of grew out of that defeat. And then the way I like to say it is they asked for more fights. They went to, in Manhattan, the Flint Hills Human Rights Project did this, and in Celina and Hutchinson, Equality Kansas went to their city hall and asked their city commission to pass ordinances protecting them from discrimination. And those became very dramatic events in those cities in 2011 through 2012, 2013. And those were a whole additional set of fights, and those were all losing also.
You know, it seems like part of what leads to the point of unity within this movement, part of the struggle to get there, is also that in Kansas, people in general are spread out, and then there's like this really increased isolation of these individual players in their separate communities dispersed through this sparsely populated, in many regions, state.
It's a beautiful state to drive around. I went to some of these super rural isolated places, and you know, I mean, I think that's one of the landscape of Kansas is one of the things everybody loves about the state. One of the reasons people care about it so much and stay and want to stay.
There's also this idea, you point out that the state's capital, Topeka, is known for two things that represent two sides of the state's political personality: Brown versus Board of Education and the Westboro Baptist Church.
Yes.
Talk about that.
if one wanted to make, I don't know, a rich, schizophrenic, significant type of civil rights pilgrimage to Topeka, one could go visit the Brown versus Board of Education historic site, which is the site of the old Monroe School, which I've done. It's a really, you know, it's a great tourist place that not many people know about. And then when one could go over and visit the Phelps compound near Gage Park and across the street, people do make pilgrimages to the Equality House and the which is the rainbow painted house across the street from the Phelps compound. And then right next to that, there's also I think it's called the Capital City for Transgender Equality. I apologize if I'm mixing that name up a little bit, but it's painted one house. There are these little ranch homes. One's painted in rainbow colors, and the other one's painted in the sort of light blue and pink of the transgender flag.
What does this all say to you about Kansas and what it means, what words like rights and equality mean in Kansas?
Kansas has a long history of those words. I mean, it's hard to sort of say one thing. I mean, think back to the founding of the state and the free state thing. And I think that if anything, there's just the activism is certainly there were loud moments of it, of, you know, rallies at the Capitol and that kind of thing. But also there are very quiet moments of people talking to their parents, people talking to their kids, their neighbors, their churches. And I think that one theme that came up a lot was just people respecting each other and people having this belief in hard work and live and let live and individuality and that, those values.
CJ Janovy, hang on with me through the break, okay?
Yeah.
When we return, some of the human stories behind the fight for LGBT rights in Kansas. I'm Gina Kaufman, back in a minute. Welcome back to KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, here with C.J. Janovy, author of No Place Like Home, Lessons in Activism in LGBT Kansas. Some of the personal stories in this book just absolutely blew my mind. Like, I really am sort of obsessed with the story of Sandra Stenzel. It is so intense.
Sandra Stenzel is a wonderful woman who lives in Trigo County, which is 5 hours west of here. The main town there is Waukini. And Sandra grew up there on a farm. Her Volga German ancestors homesteaded a piece of property in Trigo County in 1915. And she was just a farmer in her blood, grew up farming, went to 4-H, was a really sort of classic Kansas farm girl, went to college at Fort Hays State and realized she had an affinity for budgets and became sort of an economic development professional. And she ended up moving to Texas and running big economic development agencies there. She came back to Trigo County 15 years later, was running the economic development office in Trigo County.
She made a lot of change happen in her little community as the economic development coordinator.
Well, everything's relative. So she was, you know, when you talk about sort of getting money to do new streetscaping in Waukini or a study to build a new nursing home, those kinds of things. I can't remember the exact statistics, but bringing, you know, 10 new jobs to the county when nobody else did.
But she had this super fun life in Austin before that. She comes back here because, as you said, like the farm is in her blood.
Her dad dies. Her mom's getting older. She had always wanted to come back and live on the farm and work on the farm in Trigo County. So what happens is she gets back about the time of this marriage amendment. She's a Democrat. She's a lifelong Democrat. She goes and meets with some other gay folks in the Democratic world to, you know, the LGBT caucus of the Democratic Party at the time, which is sort of lame. And you know, she's among this small handful of people who fight the amendment. And she takes a day off of work, a vacation day from her job as economic development director in Trigo County, comes to Topeka to testify and talks about how hard it is to bring jobs to Kansas anyway. And if you're perceived as a state that's hostile to LGBT people, it's even harder.
Yeah, she makes an economic development argument,
yes,
against this gay marriage ban, which she does not expect to get a lot of attention. But lo and behold, it's earth-shattering.
She wakes up the next morning and, you know, she's the headline in the newspapers all across Kansas. And she immediately begins having trouble there in Waukini and is eventually forced out of her job as economic development director.
And the next 10 years, it sounds like, are just an experience in depression and isolation for
her.
This
is devastating for her because, A, she loves her community so much, and the way that she was forced out was especially devastating because this was very dramatic. There were, you know, the county commission sort of decides to disband the economic development organization, so she loses her job, but not until after a couple, two or three massive town hall meetings where everyone, you know, 200 people show up at the state fairgrounds to say, keep Sandra in her job. And she still ends up losing her job. And so she feels, you know, unwelcome suddenly in a place where hard work and a good name, which she had always had, count for a lot. And so she's sort of, yeah, she goes into isolation. She's never again has a full-time job. And
yeah, I kind of want to like go back in time and tell the woman leaving Austin, like, are you sure?
Right.
Which is, yeah, that brings up, and I want to get to her comeback, but uh-huh, it brings up, I think, an important question, which is that there are people fighting this brave fight, mm-hmm, making these sacrifices to be who they are and be those people where they're from. But, I mean, it's inspiring, the level of commitment to a place, but is it worth it?
I think that Sandra would say that having her story told at this point might have made it worth it. And I think that...
You're just a person who was part of this fight and part of this change?
Yes. And I think that, that this is one of the things about activism and why it's important to keep the long view is that there's always another fight and things change over time. And one of the big things that I think this story shows is, you know, when you think about just polls and attitudes toward same-sex marriage in 2004, the majority of Americans were against it. By 2015, when it was legal, the majority of Americans were totally for it. And how did that change in perception come? It came partly because LGBT people were out there fighting for marriage equality, but it also came about because so many people, like Sandra Stenzel and like so many of the other folks in the book, were talking to their communities and their friends and their colleagues and their coworkers about who they really were, and it opened people's minds.
Yeah, talk to me about Luann Call.
Luann Call is another person who grew up on a farm in Iowa, was Leonard Call, and struggled through into middle age with knowing that there was something that felt very wrong, and ended up moving to getting a job to run a woman's farm in Haven, Kansas, and comes to Kansas, realizes that she needs to be Luann, begins a gender transition while working as a farmhand in Haven, which is south central Kansas, not too far from Hutchinson. Then gets another, saves this woman's farm, kind of gets told she needs to leave when it becomes clear that she's really undergoing a gender transition, moves farther west to Calvesta, which is another place that is very far away and hard to get to, manages cattle, goes through this transition and joins a small handful of other activists out in Southwest Kansas to start a chapter of Equality Kansas in Dodge City.
There are people also in this book who are more part of like the college town scene in Lawrence. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a really diverse group of people. But before we go, I do want to give you a chance to tell us about how defeat does give way to progress, what that means to you.
Work. Keep working. Keep working. Prepare to lose. Roll up your sleeves and go to work.
What does the progress look like in this book?
In this book, it takes different forms for lots of different people in this book. And for me, it really gets back to that young woman who started the Gay-Straight Alliance at Hutchinson High School in 2014. And I sat in, her name's Cara Vaughn. I sat in a coffee shop with her and realized that all of these people had made a much better world for her to inherit.
Wow. CJ Janovy, thank you so much. And congratulations on your book.
Thank you.
CJ is our arts reporter here at KCUR, and she's now the author of No Place Like Home, Lessons in Activism from LGBT Kansas. She'll be giving an author talk Monday at 7 at the Lawrence Public Library, and she'll be joined by one of the people profiled in the book. That's Monday at 7 at the Lawrence Public Library. You can listen back to both of this morning's conversations, the ones about Midwestern stories and how they're being told, as well as this one about the fight for LGBT rights in Kansas at kcur.org/centralstandard. That's kcur.org/centralstandard. Tomorrow, we will have a food critics show on Chinese food in the metro. We know everyone has a favorite, so call in and tell us all about it. And tell us if you eat crab rangoon, because speaking of the Midwest, it's starting to seem like this is a Midwestern obsession, the crab rangoon, so feel free to talk about that too. This show is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, Coy Duggar, and Suzanne Hogan. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next. Don't miss it.